It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. It is your public radio station broadcasting on 100.1 FM here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where we are seeing partly cloudy skies, 33 degrees. Out at the airport, they have 45% humidity, westerly winds to 20, gusting to 33, and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is still calling for scattered snow showers starting at 1 p.m. going through 4, then scattered rain showers after that, with increasing clouds today and a high of 39, westerly winds to 30, gusting to 40. For tonight, scattered rain showers until 7, then scattered snow showers between 7 and 10. Cloudy skies will gradually give way to clear skies overnight with a low of 28, northwest winds to 30, gusting to 45. Coming up on the Midday Report, statewide candidates give their views about climate change and how they might address it. And election security.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Biden is wrapping up a campaign swing through parts of the West today. With less than a week before the midterm elections, Biden has been traveling the nation, lending his support to Democrats and touting his administration's legislative wins. Speaking at a tech company in Carlsbad, California, Biden once again praised a bipartisan law designed to boost computer chip manufacturing in the United States.
Today, we're down to producing 30% of the world's chips, from 30% to only 10%, despite leading the world in research and design of new chip technology. But we knew we had to do something to change that.
Biden will later travel to Chicago to campaign for Democratic candidates. On Saturday, he'll join former President Barack Obama for a rally in Philadelphia. More than a half a million votes have already been cast in Arizona's most populous county. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports it's an important swing district within a swing state.
Arizona was one of the first states in the nation to implement mail-in voting in the early 1990s, and hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots are typically delivered on Election Day. Maricopa County Board of Supervisors Chairman Bill Gates is continually frustrated over online conspiracy theories that somehow all of these votes will be counted by election night. By state law, officials actually can't start verifying signatures until the next day.
And this is a false narrative. And it's a dangerous narrative, and we're going to continue to push back against it.
Gates, a Republican, is among several elected leaders in Phoenix who have been continually threatened by Trump supporters and others on the right wing since the 2020 election. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes took the stand at his federal criminal trial in Washington, D.C. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports Rhodes and four other members of the far-right group are charged with seditious conspiracy and other offenses in connection with the January 6th insurrection.
Stuart Rhodes took the witness stand a day after the government rested its case. Prosecutors spent a month laying out evidence of what they say was a conspiracy led by Rhodes to use force to prevent Joe Biden from taking office. Now Rhodes and his attorneys are seeking to present a different version of events and a different picture of Rhodes himself. Wearing a dark suit and tie, Rhodes told the jury he's a patriotic American who cares deeply about the Constitution. He talked about his military experience, his family history, his path to Yale Law School, and eventually his decision to found the Oath Keepers in 2009. Rhodes is set to resume his testimony Monday. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 403 points, the Nasdaq Composite up 132, the S&P 500 up 50 points. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Alaska is at the forefront of climate change in the United States. It's warming faster than any other state, and more than 60% of Alaskans say it's an issue they're concerned about. Candidates running for statewide office were asked about their plans to address climate change, and their responses vary widely. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
Alaskans are already experiencing climate change in countless ways. A historic fall storm hit western Alaska this year, fueled by warming ocean temperatures. Permafrost thaw is buckling roads, and receding sea ice is making subsistence hunts more dangerous. At the same time, Alaska's economy is heavily dependent on oil and gas, which could explain why every candidate running for U.S. House and Senate and state governor says they support continued development in the state.
We need to drill, baby, drill.
Republican candidate for U.S. House Sarah Palin repeated her pro-development slogan at a debate last month, arguing that increasing oil production is the only way to bring down historic inflation. On a recent candidate survey, Palin called climate change a, quote, fraud. She also expressed doubts about increasing investment in renewable energy.
You know, a lot of the green energy projects, a lot of those are boondoggles. A lot of those are just some crony capitalism projects that politicians pass on to their friends.
Every statewide candidate we surveyed, except Palin, agreed that human activities are driving climate change. U.S. Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca, U.S. House candidate Nick Begich, and Governor Mike Dunleavy, all Republicans, acknowledged the impacts of human activities, but said that shouldn't translate to scaling back resource development. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Les Guerra says he supports ConocoPhillips' Willow Project and selling Alaska's oil while it's still marketable. But at the same time, Guerra has been a loud proponent of ending oil tax credits as a way to fund state services and shift to clean energy. He's talked about investing in carbon sequestration for natural gas production and building more renewable energy projects across Alaska.
The world is asking for clean energy, right? They're not asking for 1960s energy anymore. We have to catch up with the world.
Democratic House Representative Mary Paltola, also a Willow Project supporter, says Alaska is uniquely positioned to be a leader in tackling climate change. She's promised to fight for funding to support renewable energy development and study the salmon and halibut collapse in western Alaska, which has been linked to climate change. Pasha Madavi is an associate professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who researches environmental politics. He says while Alaska is feeling the brutal environmental impacts of climate change, it's also contending with the economic impacts of a world that is slowly transitioning out of fossil fuels.
That's a distinction that kind of exists across these races. You know, who is going to, at the bare minimum, just tackle the problems that Alaskans are facing right now? And then who's going to not only do that, but allow the state to thrive in the context of the transition?
Dunleavy and Chewbacca are less focused on pulling away from fossil fuels. They say oil and gas development should happen at the same time as investment in renewables. Here's Chewbacca at a recent debate.
I don't think we take an either-or approach, though, to those of us who want clean air, clean water, and clean land.
Both say that energy produced in Alaska is a, quote, cleaner option than relying on sources elsewhere in the world. In a candidate questionnaire, Dunleavy noted, for example, Alaska has laws against flaring or venting natural gas. He wrote, quote, stopping resource production in Alaska will only push it to other places with fewer environmental safeguards, end quote. Dunleavy says Alaska can be a leader in renewable energy at the same time.
We are doing everything we can, and we are, on renewables. AEA has got hundreds of millions of dollars, I should say, going towards renewable projects across Alaska.
Madavi says across the country, Americans are more concerned about climate change than ever, but candidates are split in how they're talking about it. And it's the same in Alaska. Democrats, he says, are more often discussing the environmental and economic impacts of climate change than their Republican counterparts. In Alaska, he says, that translates to a conversation where some candidates are willing to discuss a future when oil and gas is less relevant and others aren't. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Alaska Division of Elections officials say they have a solid system of checks and balances in place, and the state elections have long proven to be secure. But misinformation, skepticism, and hostility around election integrity are taking their toll on Alaska's election workers. Alaska Public Media reporter Jeremy Shea has been reporting on the issue. He sat down with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove to answer some common questions.
So what are state election officials most concerned about lately?
Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer, who's responsible for oversight of the Division of Elections, he says his biggest concern is actually homegrown misinformation from social media, especially. Election officials have been spending a lot of time addressing the public's election concerns. Meyer says some people just can't be convinced.
They still seem to believe that MyPillow guy before they'll believe me or even some of our regional supervisors. So that's been a little frustrating, and I don't know how we can get around that.
Meyer's talking about Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow. That guy's more famous now for promoting false claims about election fraud than for his own business. Meyer said when he began the job 4 years ago, malicious foreign actors were top of mind. He says they're still in play, but now skeptics like Lindell and his supporters are complimenting foreign efforts to undermine our democracy.
Does all this scrutiny and skepticism have an impact on how the state runs elections?
So the division's processes and procedures haven't changed much. Substantive changes really have to be changed in state law, which doesn't happen often. But there are other impacts. Lieutenant Governor Meyer said one regional election supervisor told him he felt like he was going to get punched in the face during a recent primary. That supervisor quit, and Meyer said it was already tough to recruit and retain election workers without a sometimes abusive work environment. So fortunately, the division's longtime operations manager says she's not aware of any major personal threats against Alaska election workers, like the sort that have been reported in other states. But the election workers issue is a real issue. If there aren't enough, that can mean longer lines and fewer polling places. Meyer said finding workers is especially tough in rural Alaska. And if the situation doesn't get better, Alaska may have to switch to an entirely vote-by-mail system.
Huh. So you mentioned that there are a lot of checks and balances to ensure our elections are accurate. Can you walk me through some of those checks and balances?
One of the most common concerns is that the machines that scan our ballots and count our votes are error-prone or may have been intentionally manipulated somehow to alter vote counts. So for the sake of argument, let's say the scanner I feed my ballot into at my polling place after I vote is somehow compromised. Election workers actually test these machines before they're used in the field, so it would likely get caught through one of those tests before any real ballots were scanned. After a ballot is scanned, it isn't discarded, so that physical paper is still there. With a few exceptions, state law requires a hand count of those physical ballots from one randomly selected precinct for every House district in the state. So that's 40 recounts, basically. If a hand count is off of the machine count by more than 1%, that's a red flag. And they started doing this back in 1998, and they've never hit that threshold. The discrepancies they do find are usually caused by ballots that are poorly marked that the machines can't read. Meyer said the Division of Elections took things further after the 2020 election. They did a hand count of the statewide vote for a close ballot measure question, the one that led to open primaries and ranked choice voting. Across hundreds of individual voting precincts, the vast majority were spot on, no errors at all. Some were off by a few votes in one direction or the other. The hand count of more than 340,000 ballots showed a net change of 171 fewer votes. The overall ratio of yes and no votes didn't really change. It was about 1/100 of 1%.
Interesting, yeah. So are the machines themselves secure?
Yeah, in two ways. So physically, when they're not in use, they're stored in monitored rooms with alarms on them. Access is limited and logged. Carol Thompson has been with the Division of Elections for 32 years and now manages election operations. She says she's dealt with her share of 2 a.m. alarms from these.
So if somebody were to break in, bells and whistles will go off, including if it's a mouse.
Which has actually happened. As far as Ocean's 11 Dream Team of hackers and burglars, not so much. The other way machines are secured is through an air gap. That's like a techie way of saying the machines involved in counting votes are not on any networks. They don't talk to each other electronically. They don't have Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. Between the air gap and physical security measures, the idea is they can't be hacked. An election security official says the scanners at precincts do briefly get connected to an external cellular modem to transmit results, then unplugged. But again, there are checks to make sure that what was sent matches what was received. And there's another air gap to get those results into tabulator machines.
Gotcha. Air gaps. I hadn't heard that before. Okay, but still, didn't the Matanuskas who sit in a borough assembly vote not too long ago to after this election go to hand counting ballots? What's up with that?
Yeah, that's a Matsu borough level decision, and that specifically affects Matsu borough elections. It doesn't affect the state's election procedures or how state election workers that happen to be in the Matsu count votes for the upcoming statewide election.
That was Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea talking with Casey Grove. If you want to dig deeper, election officials have put together a lot more information available online at elections.alaska.gov. Almost a $500,000 in federal grant funding for programming aimed at climate resiliency is going to the Kodiak Area Native Association. The money is from the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs branch of Climate Resilience. CANA will receive more than $200,000 for the development of a vulnerability assessment on both subsistence food sources and food grown locally in Kodiak. That includes studying how local and subsistence food is grown, prepared, and the economic and cultural benefits of local food. And nearly $250,000 will go toward a coastal and freshwater monitoring program for Kodiak. According to that project's description, the program would be used to help tribes establish a guidebook for community monitoring and beef up climate change data and research related to the island's salmon. The money is part of $45 million worth of federal funding that will go toward tribal climate change initiatives announced by the Bureau of Indian Affairs on Monday. The pandemic offered a unique chance for scientists to sample stress levels in humpback whales around Juneau when there was very limited tourist activity. Now scientists are looking to compare that with this year when tourism was back to almost pre-pandemic levels. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has this story.
This summer, researchers collected samples of the stress hormone cortisol from whales in Juneau waters. Susie Tierlink studies whales and monitors whale-watching practices around Juneau through a federal program. She says they take the samples using a dart, which probably feels like a bee sting to the whales.
In blubber, it takes weeks and months to accumulate. And so we're getting more of a cumulative average of what their physiological stress environment has been in the weeks and months prior.
Tierlink says that they took those samples from blubber, which stores the hormone longer than blood does.
Generally speaking, after we take a biopsy sample, we do monitor whales for some period of time, and by and large, they go back to what they were doing before.
Yeah.
So we think that it's a pretty small impact.
That also makes sure that the sample doesn't reflect the whale getting temporarily stressed by the dart that takes the sample. A 2019 study used instruments posted on land that observed the whales without influencing their behavior. The instruments record respiratory rates, dive patterns, and speeds of the whales. This tracked the more immediate behavioral differences, minute by minute.
And what they found is that, especially as the number of boats increased, they did see faster swimming speeds, faster rates of respiration, longer downtimes, changes in direction.
That study was led by Heidi Pearson with the University of Alaska Southeast. Pearson is also the lead investigator for this year's stress study.
And so then we realized we had this really golden opportunity to look at humpback whales at a time of reduced vessel traffic.
She said they biopsied 24 whales in total and that they're using photographic data to track which whales are coming and going.
And so we're also trying to determine if there's a change in residency or how long whales are here each year, and also how many whales are here each year, because we predict that there might be changes in how many whales are here or how long they stay depending on the vessel traffic.
Tierlink, Pearson, and their research group are expecting results from this latest round of data this spring. That will be just in time to help better inform whale watching practices in Juneau for next season. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
The word Renaissance is borrowed from the French language. It means rebirth. The Renaissance period is best known for renewed interest in the culture of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, leading to an intellectual and artistic rebirth of classical antiquity. It was only in the 19th century that the word Renaissance achieved popularity to describe this cultural movement based on Greco-Roman models. The Renaissance is considered to have begun in Florence in the 14th century, and it soon began to spread to the rest of Italy. Italy at the time didn't exist as a political entity, but was divided into small city-states. Artists depended entirely on patrons, while the patrons needed money to promote artistic talent. Abundant riches in Italy allowed the Renaissance to flourish in the region. The Renaissance was marked by its own version of humanism, which was based on ancient Greco-Roman philosophies. Renaissance humanism was derived from the study of five humanities: poetry, grammar, history, moral philosophy, and rhetoric. Though humanism would later challenge traditional religious beliefs, at the time it was in no way anti-Christian or anti-religious. The 19th century belief that the Renaissance challenged the church or changed conservative social order is now disregarded by most historians. At the time of the Renaissance, there was religious turmoil with accusations of corruptions against the Roman Catholic Church. The Renaissance's humanism helped spark the Protestant Reformation, which resulted in many people moving away from the Catholic Church and creating Protestant churches. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the fourth day of November, the year 2022. The sun rose at 9:30. It will set again at 6:14. That will give us 8 hours and 44 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 34 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 57 degrees set in 2017, and a record low was 10 set in 1985. And it's currently 34 degrees, and they have westerly winds at 23 gusting to 35 out at the airport right now with 46% humidity, 10 miles of visibility. And even though they're calling for sunny conditions tomorrow and Sunday, and it's mostly sunny right now, the Weather Service insists that we will see scattered snow showers going back and forth with scattered rain showers between about 2 this afternoon and about 11 tonight. After that, though, they're expected to see gradually clearing skies tonight, low of around 28, westerly winds to 30, gusting to 45. And for tomorrow, sunny skies, high near 32, northwest winds to 35, gusting to 50. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up at 5:33. High tide coming up at, just happened actually, at 12:05 this afternoon here on the east side. Our next low tide will be at 6:14. That will be a 1.5-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 12:15 a.m., just after midnight, of 7.7 feet. Over on the east side, you will have a high tide here at about 10 minutes at 12:35 this afternoon, a 13.6-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 6:56 this afternoon of 1.8 feet, and your next high tide will be at 12:52, about 1 a.m., a 12.5-foot tide in Larsen Bay. Mariners, be aware, we do have a gale warning through Saturday from Marmot Island to Sitkenek, Kodiak's east side. Northwest 45 today, becoming west 35 in the afternoon, seas to 13 feet. Northwest 45 tonight, seas to 15 feet. Northwest 40 tomorrow, seas to 16 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, gale warning through Saturday. West winds to 35 knots today, seas to 9 feet with freezing spray. For tonight, northwest 40, seas to 11 feet with freezing spray. And for tomorrow, northwest 40, seas 10 feet, subsiding to 7 feet tomorrow afternoon with freezing spray. Saturday night, northwest 35, seas to 7 feet in the Shelikof. Everyone down at the Aleutic Museum would like to see that everyone in Kodiak gets a chance to see the ceremonial masks and beaded regalia that are on loan from the museum in France and have to be returned this month. If you go there on Saturday, November 5th, you can get free admission to see these special items. These beautiful objects were collected on Kodiak Island in the 1800s. Also on Saturday, the American Association of University Women are having their annual holiday bazaar. That's happening from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Kodiak High School gym. You can enter either through the high school or the auditorium doors. It's fun for the whole family, and they would ask that you please bring your own shopping bag. Again, that's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Kodiak High School gym, the annual holiday bazaar from the Association of University Women. There will be a Board of Education work session immediately followed by a special meeting on November 7th, Monday, beginning at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room F140 of the old high school wing. The meeting will also be streamed through BlueJeans. Login information is posted at the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website under the Board of Education tab. For more information, contact the Secretary to the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. The Kodiak City Council will be having a work session next Tuesday, November 8th. That meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. and be held in the Kodiak Public Library. They will also be having a regular meeting on Thursday, November 10th. That meeting will also begin at 7:30 p.m. and be held in the library. Both meetings are open to the public, and the public is also encouraged to tune in right here at KMXT on 100.1 FM. They will also be web streamed, and the link for that, as well as meeting packets, are available at the City of Kodiak website. For more information, call the city clerk at 907-486-8636. The Fairwind Players is presenting Boo. It's a celebration of the spooky season, and it's a collection of short plays, 13 of them, each designed to tickle your funny bone and make your skin crawl. They're happening Friday, November 11th and Saturday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Drama Pod. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for 15 and under. Again, that's Friday, November 11th, Saturday, November 12th, 7 p.m. at the Gerald C. Drama Pod. Galley Tables is looking for a few storytellers for their season opening event on November 19th. The theme is Home Again, and storytellers have 7 minutes to tell their story. If you'd like to tell a story, email them at galleytables@gmail.com or sign up at the Galley Tables website at galleytables.com.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the November 4th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Have you noticed the moon lately? It's been a lovely harvest gold color the last several nights in the early evening. Jupiter is shining brightly to the left of the moon. You can't miss it because they are the two brightest things in the sky in the evening. On Monday night and early Tuesday morning, we get to witness a total lunar eclipse when the Earth is directly between the sun and the moon. The total eclipse begins shortly after midnight when the Earth's shadow begins to cover the moon. Over the next hour or so, you'll see the shadow advancing over the moon. And then, during the total eclipse, the moon becomes a magical, mystical, reddish-orange color. That's because our atmosphere doesn't filter out the red color in sunlight as much as it does other colors. Those reddish light rays bend around the Earth and reflect back off the moon while it's in the Earth's shadow. So if you go out around midnight, you'll get to watch the shadow as it advances across the moon's surface, and then from about 1:15 to 2:40, the moon will be in total eclipse and it will be red. For the next hour, you can watch as the Earth's shadow covers less and less of the moon's surface. I know it's the middle of the night, but it's worth watching at least part of the eclipse. It's pretty cool to see. And this is the last total lunar eclipse until March of 2025. All the more reason to watch part of this one. Kodiak is full of amazing artists and craftspeople, and we get to enjoy their work on Saturday at the AAUW Bazaar. Spend some time on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the high school gym shopping for the holidays. You'll be glad you did. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Don't forget to turn your clocks back on Sunday night and to look for the eclipse in the wee hours of Tuesday morning. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.